Justice had significant concern about election fraud there and in other states. The former acting Deputy Attorney General, Richard Donohue, was scolding as he detailed Trump's efforts to replace the acting Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, with Jeffrey Clark in late December 2020, and to pressure state legislatures to reject Joe Biden electors by promoting baseless charges of widespread election fraud. Richard Donohue recounted how he warned Donald Trump at a bizarre 3rd of January White House meeting that was attended by Jeffrey Rosen, Donald Trump counsel Pat Cipollone, and other top lawyers, that elevating Clark to be acting Attorney General would spark mass resignations, and Clark would be left leading a graveyard at the Justice Department. Pat Cipollone, who was recently subpoenaed by the House panel, also threatened to resign if Jeffrey Clark replaced Jeffrey Rosen. Further, according to shocking testimony on 28th of June by Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Cipollone warned her early on 6th of January of potential criminal liability for Trump and others if Donald Trump went to the Capitol as he had discussed doing, and asked Hutchinson to please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol. All of it adds to potentially grave consequences for the three lawyers. Michael Zeldin, a former Department of Justice prosecutor, said the strong evidence presented about the fake electoral scheme at a recent House committee hearing, including testimony by senior Justice Department officials, laid the foundation for charging Trump's legal advisers, John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani, and possibly Jeffrey Clark, with multiple state and federal crimes, including obstruction of an official congressional proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the United States, false statements in connection with the fake electoral scheme, and election fraud. Michael Zeldin added, "The cumulative evidence presented over the course of the hearings paint a picture of a president who was told explicitly by multiple people that he'd lost the election, and that once he exhausted his judicial remedies, losing nearly 60 cases, his continuing pressure campaign to prevent the orderly transfer of power was illegal. Yet Trump and his attorneys persisted." Other former prosecutors stressed that the FBI raids to obtain Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones indicate the investigations of the two lawyers have escalated. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, told The Guardian, "Search warrants of Jeffrey Clark and John Eastman's phones means that a judge found probable cause to believe that evidence of a crime would be found on each of those devices. John Eastman's exposure to criminal charges has been palpable and growing for months. In March, a federal judge, David Carter, in a crucial court ruling involving Donald Trump's legal adviser, John Eastman, stated that Trump, more likely than not, broke the law in his weeks-long drive to stop Joe Biden from taking office. In a civil case which resulted in an order for John Eastman to release more than 100 emails he had withheld from the House panel, Judge David Carter wrote, "Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history." Other revelations damaging to Donald Trump and John Eastman emerged at a mid-June House panel hearing with Greg Jacob, the former counsel to former Vice President Mike Pence, providing detailed testimony about how Eastman and Trump launched a high-pressure effort to persuade Mike Pence to unlawfully block Joe Biden's certification by Congress on 6th of January 2021. The John Eastman pressure included the scheme to substitute pro-Trump fake electors from states that Biden won for electors rightfully pledged to Biden. Greg Jacob testified that Eastman acknowledged to him that he knew his push to get Mike Pence on 6th of January to reject Biden's winning Electoral College count would violate the Electoral Count Act, and that Donald Trump, too, was informed it would be illegal for Mike Pence to block Joe Biden's certification. In mid-December of 2020, at least 59 Republicans from states that Trump had lost falsely asserted and signed legal documents that they were duly chosen electors for Trump in the Electoral College. Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for Eastern Michigan, said former prosecutors say potential charges against Trump and his top lawyers have increased in part due to the powerful details that former Department of Justice leaders testified about on 23rd of June, involving how Trump pushed to weaponize the Justice Department to facilitate the fake electoral scheme. Barbara McQuaid noted that the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, months ago confirmed Department of Justice had received evidence from state attorney generals about alternate slates of electors and was investigating. It appears that Department of Justice is now issuing subpoenas regarding this episode. One could imagine each link leading to the next and possibly all the way to Donald Trump. On top of Trump's involvement in the fake electors ploy, former Deputy Attorney General Donald Eyre, who served in the George H.W. Bush administration, told The Guardian that overall, the evidence is increasingly showing Trump's culpability. Donald Trump had extensive involvement in long conversations where he was personally working intently to overturn the election. Donald Eyre's point was bolstered by Cassidy Hutchinson's eye-popping testimony about Trump's knowledge of and indifference to the large cache of dangerous weapons that were being carried by his supporters to the Capitol. Paul Pelletier, a former acting chief of Department of Justice Fraud Section, said that for prosecutors, the powerful testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson might be the final nail in the legal jeopardy coffin of Trump's coterie of lawyers and enablers. He added, Hutchinson's testimony has lifted the curtain on the false narrative that the violent Capitol confrontation was spontaneous. The Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse sees a need for coordination of criminal investigations between the Department of Justice and others into the multiple efforts by Trump and key allies to block Joe Biden's win in Georgia, including Trump's call to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, which is under scrutiny by the Fulton County District Attorney and a special grand jury. Sheldon Whitehouse told The Guardian, phony electors, the Jeffrey Clark memo and Trump's phone calls all converge on Georgia. He added, I hope and expect that the investigations are coordinated. The raid on Jeffrey Clark shows how serious this is, and false electors could make great witnesses.
Economic Divide.
The Puerto Rico Power Company brought out the anger of Puerto Ricans recently, who took to the streets slamming the government for its bad economic policies. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. The economy in that country was not doing well, and that's one of the main reasons why they came out, a result of U.S. execution of things like bond selling, privatization, and malicious Wall Street debt restructurings. Hi, I'm Kaveh Tahweh. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up in this program, the PR Puerto Rican electric company controversy, rates to have doubled, governor vetoed price increase bill, that angered the citizens of that island. Why did he do that? That's one of the things we'll be looking at. Also, the debt of Puerto Rico. Chronic debt for years. The island is blaming the U.S. government. What role did the U.S. government have to play in this? One of the reasons they blame the U.S., the debt adjustment plan. We'll explain to you what that is. Then another issue that has plagued the island, subject of much debate, Puerto Rican independence, separation from the U.S. Why? Because it does not have the rights that it deserves under the U.S. and the U.S. Constitution. Recently, Puerto Ricans held demonstrations against the local government for its contract with the power grid operator Luma Energy. Demonstrators were fed up with the frequent power outages and massive price hikes. They say that the government needs to remedy the crisis. Since June 2020, when Luma began operating Puerto Rico's electricity transmission, price rates have increased 5 times. The last rate hike, which took effect at the start of July, pushed rates up by over 17%. Back in 2017, Puerto Rico was devastated by the powerful Hurricane Maria, which completely destroyed the island's power grid. Puerto Rico's electricity was already struggling due to low maintenance and poor collection of power bills. Natural disasters, the coronavirus pandemic, migration, government mismanagement, and brutal U.S. debt restructuring plan, just some of the issues that has plagued Puerto Rico. The economic problems are so deep that many are actually fleeing the island looking for jobs in the U.S. Let's take a look at what people think about some of these economic problems as they have posted online. First up, Puerto Ricans took to the streets of San Juan to fight back against U.S.-imposed privatization of their electricity. Power outages and electricity costs have only increased since Luma Energy took control of the island's electrical grid in 2020. Then Puerto Rican government sitting on $8 billion in cash and uses bankruptcy code to avoid paying $57 million in debt service. The Puerto Rican government and board have hidden real financial conditions of government and litigated against creditors. Unclear that there will ever be market access at reasonable rates. Along the same lines, fees and expenses related to the restructuring of Puerto Rico's debt are forecast to reach $1.6 billion by fiscal year 2026, cementing the island status as the most expensive municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. Next up, lots of lawyers, CPAs, bankers, finance guys are getting filthy rich. By the way, those were the same people who facilitated the debt binge that bankrupted us or Puerto Rico. All right, joining us to give an idea about the status of Puerto Rico's economy, we have Edwin Irizarry Mora. He's a professor of economics at the University of Puerto Rico joining us. Edwin Irizarry Mora, welcome. Protesters in Puerto Rico are protesting against the rise in electricity prices by Luma Energy. 7 consecutive price rises. It's affecting their lives. And they are complaining about that and, of course, the state of the economy. What is this price rise a result of? A poor governance, do you think?
Well, the issue of electric power production and distribution has been under public discussion for decades. Luma enters in the scenario as a Puerto Rican, as a corporation, I mean, that has been hired to privatize the electric power service. Its presence means that the price is now determined by a private monopoly, and hence the 120% increase in the cost of electricity over the past year, with the justification that the cost of the kilowatt hour generation is high. That's because the monopoly has been established. Of course, it is high. To the extent that electricity is generated with imported fossil fuels, it will continue to be high. On the other hand, from a technical point of view, the presence of a private company does not mean that renewable sources of energy will be adopted. Luma will continue to produce electricity with the same methods whose vulnerability is accentuated when natural disasters, especially hurricanes, occur. All of the above leads us to conclude that there is a serious governance problem in this issue, and that, unfortunately, the country's government does not listen to the advice of experts on the subject, because the country's colonial situation imposes on whom fuel is purchased and how electricity is going to be generated. That is why the population has taken to the streets to protest, and with more than justified reasons.
All right, let's bring in Isaac Biggio, see what he thinks. He is an historian and international analyst who joins us. Isaac Biggio, welcome. Protesters are demanding the governor to resign because of this veto that he exercised, preventing further increases in the price of electricity. The bill was proposed to eliminate 75% of the debt also that was held by the Puerto Rican company. Why is it said that the public debt is a product of Puerto Rico's colonial relationship with the U.S.?
Yes, because in Puerto Rico, they are not interested in the situation of the 3 million people that live there, but rather in the interest of the big USA companies. That is why they are increasing the prices of the electricity, despite that Puerto Rico suffered a big hurricane, the pandemic. They increase the prices of the electricity, and they don't want to go back to public owner electricity. So they prefer to privatize the company and to privatize many services, because that's the policy of the USA, which are not interested in protecting their own population.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we take a look at news from around the world with economic flavor to it. Our first news item is on a part of the world that experienced quite a bit of tensions and is still ongoing, a result of the fallout of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Chinese Taipei. And it concerns the Taiwan chip industry. Now, why China is not sanctioning Taiwan's key chip industry? Beijing is relying on self-ruled islands as semiconductors, because that will keep its economy on track. Now, we know that China did not like the fact that Nancy Pelosi visited that island. Military operations to the extreme is what they executed. And they also, Chinese authorities, suspended imports of Taiwanese citrus fruits and fish and exports of sand. And that could be just the beginning. So we have to wait and see how that goes. Next up, a topic that we have tackled quite a bit, and that is about the global recession that's really in place. Investors are dumping Chinese stocks. This is one factor that is leading to a global recession, or indications of it. They're also dumping bonds amid global recession fears. The trade group that reported this is pointing to the sixth consecutive month of foreign outflows from China's bond market. The bond market is valued at roughly $20 trillion. That's right, $20 trillion. Next up, what's called a G20 revolt, maybe with a question mark, but it's something that has actually started. G20 states are revolting against U.S. pressure. Half of the G20 nations have not supported the sanctions when it comes to Russia. That's right. It went on to say that the U.S.-led drive to isolate Russia through sanctions has not succeeded, as half the countries in the group of 20 leading global economies are refusing to sign on to that. We have to wait and see how that pans out. And our final pick is on the UK. Again, we've had the UK quite a bit. This concerns the UK energy bills in that country. Well, Brits are not having it. 75,000 of them have vowed to stop paying their energy bills because they're so high. They're going to be tripled in a very short time. The UK government has slammed the Don't Pay campaign, and it has described it as being highly irresponsible. That economy in the UK, obviously one of the aspects, is showing signs of destruction, especially when it comes to people's lives.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our in-depth section. The state of Puerto Rico's economy, well, it's in shambles with so much debt. How can this island hope to get back on its feet? It is still suffering from hurricanes like Hurricane Maria, which left the island's infrastructure in ruins. First, let's start out with a comparison of Puerto Rico's electric bills compared to the U.S. That's a good place to see how much more Puerto Ricans are actually paying for it. We have picked three categories that electricity is used in. Namely, the categories would be commercial, industrial, and residential. The one in red being what Puerto Ricans pay. The one in the orange is what the U.S. pays. And as you can see, based on this graph, the question comes, how can businesses survive on this kind of energy costs, which cuts into their bottom line so severely, never mind how Puerto Ricans can afford an electric bill that's so high. Again, commercial, industrial, residential, all three categories, you can see that Puerto Ricans are paying so much more, maybe double or more than double in the commercial sector. Residential, not that bad. Industrial, still how much more Puerto Ricans are paying. Okay, let's move on to another graph. This one is very important. This graph shows the GDP performance of the island in terms of how its economy is doing. And Puerto Rico's GDP, well, starting from the year 2012, it did have a slight move in the positive direction, but from 2013, 14, 15, 16, all the way through 18, and then you had a slight bump in 19, and then 2020 back. You've had GDP contractions in which the year 2018 came down to more than negative 4%. So you can see that this economy in Puerto Rico has not been doing well, and consecutive contractions have occurred. Bright spot, the year 2021, there was a bit of a bump. That's a promising sign, which it had a positive GDP growth. All right, let's move on to another challenge that the island is facing. This one is huge. It's massive debt and the obligations that it has. Looking at this particular graph over here, these are the top categories of which there needs to have been a restructuring. And what we can see are public pensions, general obligation bonds, and sales tax supported bonds. A grand total of $129 billion of debt restructuring that was required in total. Then you can see the figures over here where the restructuring actually needed to take place. This figure adds up to $86 billion, which was proposed for the debt restructuring. That proposal has actually gone into action. And, of course, you can imagine how hard that is when the island is actually not generating the revenues needed to pay back this debt. So this kind of puts into picture the amount of money in debt it accrued and the restructuring that has taken place. All right, next up, another few indicators of why Puerto Rico's economy just doesn't pick up. This one, we zoomed in on the population growth. Puerto Rican population growth on mainland declines on island, meaning that the ones who live in Puerto Rico actually end up going to the U.S., and you can see the ones in this graph showing how that population is migrating into the U.S. That's another crisis that Puerto Rico is dealing with. When you have people leaving the islands and migrating there, then there's a decline on the island, which means there's a decrease in terms of economic activity. Next up, we're going to take a look at some of the reasons why people are leaving the island. These are pretty typical of actually any country, to be honest. Job-related category is number one at 42%, household and family at 38%, the retired at 7%. These are the main reasons why Puerto Ricans, and the last one is just miscellaneous, the main reasons why Puerto Ricans are actually leaving the island. And as if all these factors were not enough, there is a population decline as a whole for the island. And that decline is not something that actually just occurred. We're looking all the way from the year 2000, 3.8 million Puerto Ricans, and then the gradual decline. It's been steadily declining all the way through to where we are, which is the year 2022, and the projections are through the year 2050. God, all the way through the year 2050. Imagine that, if that were to transpire. All right, let me introduce our guests who are going to rejoin us. Edwin Irizarry-Mora, professor of economics at the University of Puerto Rico, rejoins us to maybe give us some idea of how bad Puerto Rico's economy is doing. All right, Edwin, welcome back to the program. Taking a look at how the U.S. has required that the island needs to repay its debt, it's called the Mechanism to Pay This Debt. The Debt Adjustment Plan is the name. It proposes cuts to the island's government budget and threatens essential services. Do you think that that is the way to go when it comes to Puerto Rico repaying its debt? Will it work, aside from preventing the economy to grow?
As I said earlier, since 2016, the Fiscal Oversight Board has determined the priorities of expenditures in Puerto Rico's budget. Undoubtedly, the research carried out in recent years confirms the deterioration of the quality of life of Puerto Ricans in fundamental areas of our collective life, such as public health, pre-university and university education, housing, transportation, and others. An economic system that responds politically to the interests of the United States companies, to creditors who lend money to the government, and to Puerto Rican intermediaries who benefit from that situation because they enrich themselves with the colonial relationship.
Indeed. Well, let's find out what Isaac Biggio thinks. He's a historian and international analyst. Isaac Biggio, welcome back. When you take a look at the way that Puerto Rico's debt has been restructured in particular, obviously this was done with the participation of companies, of creditors. Many of them are obviously Wall Street companies, through what is called the Debt Adjustment Plan. Many are saying that this is bankrupting Puerto Rico in a sense, even though the island was bankrupt. Can you explain to us the relationship there and whether this actually prevents the economy in Puerto Rico from advancing in order to repay its debt?
Yes. And the point is that in 1898, there was a war between Spain and the United States. As a consequence of that war, the United States occupies Cuba, Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Cuba became independent. Philippines just celebrate it's on the 4th of July, its independence. It was achieved in 1945. But Puerto Rico is still a kind of colony from the United States. And I don't think that Puerto Rico is going to increase its own conditions unless it breaks with the United States and become another Latin American republic.
Puerto Rico stands in a colonial relationship with the U.S. The U.S. territory has been plagued with recurring debt issues. The island is suffering from an aging population and high costs for social programs. Many of its residents have also left the island because of its debt problem. And access to financial markets is not likely to happen soon because the island needs to get its audited financial statements up to date. Furthermore, the island is struggling with the aftermaths of the devastating 2017 hurricane, which left it in tatters. The island has now formally exited bankruptcy, but it came at the expense of tough austerity measures imposed by Washington. The measures made the conditions almost unbearable for ordinary Puerto Ricans. Power grids, railways, healthcare, and other public services were privatized in order to restructure the island's debt crisis.
The debt that Puerto Rico has accumulated is what is dragging down the island's economy. But what led to the island accumulating so much debt? Is there a hidden story there which led to the island recording the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history? Our first cue actually came from an online post, and that is what this post particularly stated. UBS bonds are doing a Ponzi scheme in Puerto Rico. They're taking people's life savings and lying to people, don't buy UBS bonds, the PR government is a Ponzi scheme from U.S. corporations. It goes on to say not to trust UBS bonds, saying that they're Americanized Puerto Rican bonds contributing to the debt. Taking people's life savings, that it is, a Ponzi scheme from U.S. corporations. So what was going on with UBS? What was so wrong about the bonds it was selling? Despite the downgrade from UBS Puerto Rico's bonds to junk status as recently as October 2014, UBS Puerto Rico was recommending that some Puerto Rico clients continue to purchase risky UBS closed-end bond funds that help many of the risky Puerto Rico bonds. Here, it is necessary to explain what a junk bond actually is. In finance, junk bonds are bonds that are rated below investment grade, meaning they're believed to be at a higher risk of default. Because of this high risk, they pay higher yields than better quality bonds to make them more attractive to investors. But this doesn't answer the question, why did the investors buy these bonds in the first place? That is because investors in Puerto Rican municipal bonds received favorable tax treatments for years. Bond investors from all 50 states took advantage of this benefit by purchasing Puerto Rican bonds. When a government issues bonds, it is effectively lending money with interest to bondholders. Promoted in large part by this tax advantage, Puerto Rico issued too much bond debt and began relying on borrowed funds from bond issuance to balance its budget. And that is one of the main reasons Puerto Rico's economy tanked when banks like UBS sold these bonds. That does it for this segment of the program. Please let us know what you thought by ending us with your comments. And that is one of the main reasons Puerto Rico's economy tanked when banks like UBS sold these bonds. That does it for this segment of the program.
Puerto Rico's economy has not been doing well for quite some time. Now, we cited since the year 2012. But even before that, jobs were hard to come by, and the island was just not invested in, except for the tourism and the hospitality sector. Well, the island also is suffering from another problem not mentioned that often, and that's drugs and crime. Also, another factor plaguing the island is political status. As U.S. territory, Puerto Rico is neither a state nor an independent country. Maybe that is what is preventing the economy from advancing. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. For Miko Vitale, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today, I'm going to watch a polo game. Oh God, it would be a new attractive experience. I've never seen such a game before. Tell you something. What made me decide to have a visit to a polo game today was my recent visit of an art museum in Tehran. There, I saw some stunning antique Persian miniature paintings depicting polo players. Oh, they were amazing. You can't believe it. Well, I have to rush. Not much time left to the beginning of the game. And the traffic is heavy as always. Polo, or Chogan, was formed in Iran around 600 BC and was played during the Achaemenid era. Polo became popular in India during the reign of Darius I. It was also part of the game culture of the Sassanid era. Renowned Iranian poets, including Rudaki, Ferdowsi, Sa'di, Hafez, Nasser Khosrow, and Maulana, have mentioned polo in their poetry several times. Polo flourished during the Safavid era. Historical documents show that Shah Abbas played polo, and even he played polo in Qazvin, the second capital of Iran. In Isfahan, Naqsh-e-Jahan Square was also built for polo. The Europeans became acquainted with the game during the Safavid era and their colonization in India. Okay, here it is. Perfect complex for practicing polo in Tehran. It's big and equipped. And you can't believe how many people have gathered here to watch the game. On my right, the horsemen or the players are coming out of the stable with their horses, preparing for the game. Well, I think this sport is much different from other sports or games because there should be a harmony between one part, which is human, with the other member of the team, which is an animal, a horse. Well, there are two teams in the field. Amazing! I really can't describe the excitement of the game. Some of the spectators are using cameras to watch the game better. I wish I had one. Each team consists of four players, each using mallets with long, flexible handles to drive a wooden ball down a grass field. An exciting experience.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Praise be to God, Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household. And may God curse all their enemies. It is very nice to have you here, dear brothers and sisters. After 2 years, I am meeting some of you again in this Husseiniyah. One of the best meetings and one of the sweetest social interactions is the meeting held on the birth anniversary of Hazrat Zahra, salamullah alayha, which has been held annually with you dear ones. I think this meeting has been held for the past 35 years now. I wish to express my congratulations on the birth anniversary of the master of all women, Siddiqatul Tahira, Fatimatul Zahra, salamullah alayha, and also the birth anniversary of our magnanimous Imam. I wish to say a few things about Lady Zahra, peace be upon her, as a token of our respect. Then I will say a few sentences about eulogists and hay'ats, that is, groups of people who hold religious gatherings to remember and honour the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. Of course, this day is Women's Day and Mother's Day as well.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A number of honorable women have complained that we should dedicate this day to just women. They are right, but this is a deep-rooted, long-standing meeting, and it cannot be underestimated. We should also set a day for meeting with just women as well, God willing. Our language and words are too limited and incomplete to describe the great status of the Immaculate Zahra, the Pure Lady. The Holy Quran and reliable traditions have spoken about this great personality. There are eulogies about her in such sources, but they require deliberation and thinking due to our limited minds for us to be able to understand them. This tradition that our magnanimous Imam Khomeini once narrated, that the angel Gabriel would descend upon Lady Zahra after the demise of the Holy Prophet, is a correct narration. When we looked at the source and documentation for this tradition, we saw that it was completely reliable. There is no doubt that Gabriel used to visit her. It has been related, when Gabriel would come to see her, he would condole her for the death of her father, comfort her, tell her about her father, where he was and how he was in Barzakh, purgatory. Gabriel would inform Fatima al-Zahra about the Prophet's position with God the Merciful and his high status. He would tell her about the events that were to unfold for her children in the future.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
American voters on tribal lands are more than twice as likely to face removal. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Kevin Morris and Peter Miller and Brennan Center for Justice. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Non-White Voters Face High Risk of Being Dropped from Arizona's Mail Ballot List. Here's more. The past year has been characterized by widespread assaults on voting rights across the U.S. This has been especially true in swing states where the 2020 presidential election saw narrow margins. As Will Wilder, journalist, explains, even among these states, Arizona stands out as a focal point for the fight over voting rights. In the U.S., we look at one provision of Arizona Senate Bill 1485, which was passed into law in May 2021, but won't be in effect for the midterms. The bill turns Arizona's extremely popular permanent early voting list into an active early voting list. Voters on the list are automatically mailed
a ballot before every election. Under the new rules, Arizonans will be removed from the list if they go 4 years without casting a ballot by mail, even if a voter participates but only does so in person, they will fall off the list. Like in much of the western United States, Arizonans have a robust history of casting their votes by mail. Since 2010, an average of 2/3 of the electorate has voted by mail. Like 4 other states, Arizona has allowed voters to sign up to receive a ballot in the mail for all elections, obviating the need to fill out a new absentee ballot request form for each and every contest. According to voter file data from L2 Political, some 3 million Arizonans, roughly 75% of the electorate, were on the list in April of 2021, shortly before SB 1485 was passed. To analyze the expected effects of the law, we looked at voter file data from L2 Political, which records whether and how each voter participated in an election. Although voters won't be removed from the list for a few years, we wanted to know who would be impacted based on the list, as it was when the legislature was considering this change. To do so, we looked at which voters on the list cast a mail ballot in any election in 2017, 2018, 2019 or 2020. If they voted by mail in any of these elections, they are considered not at risk of being dropped. They are considered at risk if they did not cast a mail ballot. In Arizona, voters do not self-identify their race or ethnicity when they register to vote. To estimate each voter's race or ethnicity, we use a technique common among political scientists called Bayesian improved surname geocoding, which predicts race or ethnicity based on each voter's last name and the demographics of the census block in which they live. This method is widely used by academics and voting rights litigators alike to predict racial or ethnic demographics. While it cannot perfectly estimate any individual's race or ethnicity, it has very low error rates at the population level. This method considers Latino to be mutually exclusive from other races or ethnicities. Put differently, a voter is considered either white or black or Latino. To be clear, being dropped from the permanent early voting list doesn't mean that a voter will be disenfranchised. They will receive a notice from the state indicating that they have been removed and can then either re-list or vote in person. However, many voters might miss the notification in the mail, and mail delivery is not always reliable. As such, some people might not end up voting if they don't receive their expected mail ballot. And for all voters, the requirement to rejoin the list of mail voters imposes the sort of a small cost that can add up to major burdens on their right to vote, a problem under any circumstances, and doubly so when the costs have such clear racial disparities on the Arizona bill. And this adds up to big discrepancies in the overall number of voters who could be dropped when broken down by race and ethnicity. Although 31% of voters on the list are non-white, these voters make up half of those at risk of being dropped. All non-white racial groups are overrepresented among those at risk of being removed, but not as much as Latino voters. Latino voters make up just 17% of the permanent early voters who aren't at risk of being dropped.
but more than a third of those who might fall off the list. The figure shows the relative risk ratio that each racial group faces of being removed from their list. If a group's share of the at-risk population is equal to its share of the total population, the group's risk ratio is 1. A risk ratio about 1 indicates that a given group is overrepresented in the at-risk population. And each racial or ethnic group expect for white Arizonans is about 1%, although the risk ratio for Asian American voters is very close to 1. Undermining the permanent early voting list also spells danger for Arizona's Native American communities. Because Native Americans make up a relatively small share of the population, it is often difficult to identify them using techniques such as surname geocoding. As an alternative, we used the geocoded voter file and census shape files to identify voters who live on Native American tribal lands. To be sure, this misses Native Americans who live off reservations. Nevertheless, it is helpful to know whether individuals living on reservations are disproportionately harmed by the new law. The difference is stark. About 23% of voters on the list who reside on tribal lands are at risk of removal, compared to only 11.6% of permanent early voters statewide. In other words, voters on tribal lands are more than twice as likely to face removal. These results make plain that SB 1485, like so many other policies that restrict access to voting, will have a disproportionate effect on voters of color and Native American voters in the U.S.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands of South Korean unionists and their progressive supporters rallied in downtown Seoul to protest against joint U.S.-South Korea war games planned for later this month. The drills will be the largest in years and follow the May election of President Yoon Suk-yeol, who's promised to take a hard line with North Korea. Union leaders worry about risks.
The threat of nuclear war is growing on the Korean Peninsula. Conservative forces of Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea and those in the U.S. are frantically conducting aggressive war drills in the sky, the land, and the sea, and are about to start large-scale joint military exercises aimed at the invasion of North Korea. We must stamp out this behavior of anti-reunification forces.
While many South Koreans, especially supporters of President Yoon on the right, favor close ties with the U.S., large numbers also argue the U.S. military and the country's alliance with Washington prevent the improvement of ties with North Korea and generate tension.
We not only oppose the war exercises, but we want the U.S. forces, Korea, which is actually controlling and interfering with the Korean Peninsula, to leave this land. We believe that only then will the 80 million Koreans from both North and South be able to live peacefully.
The drills will reportedly involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group with extensive field training to include amphibious maneuvers. South Korea has also been training alongside U.S. forces with recently acquired American F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. In an effort to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance, military officials from Seoul and Washington will meet to discuss the deployment of U.S. strategic assets and extended deterrence.